colleagues and comrades. On my side, it's 11 minutes past 12. That means it's afternoon. I'm not sure what is the time in Nigeria and in France. But I want to welcome you to our webinar. This is the webinar that has been organized by the Southern African office, coming from the concern that coronavirus pandemic is still here to live with us. It's not an event that will pass, but we might be sitting with it for quite a long time. Besides that, it has made its mark in history. It will definitely go down on the history of the world. I don't want to elongate my welcoming, but I've got two speakers that are going to welcome the participants and make their own opening remarks. Let me first start by calling to the podium the Regional Secretary, Comrade Sani.
Thank you, Sister Rita. Good morning, comrades. I'm really very happy to be a part of this program. This is a webinar which we are organizing sub-region by sub-region to look at the issues around COVID and also how it impacts on us generally as workers, our unions, and also members of the larger society. And so far we have held one for the Arab sub-region, and this is the second one. Then we'll continue with the remaining two for English-speaking West and East and West Africa, and of course the French-speaking Africa. Then finally, we'll also round up with a regional program looking at all the issues contained or we have faced over the last few 13 to 15 months due to the COVID. Comrades, the purpose of this webinar has been well elaborated in the concept note. And but on our part is to keep hope alive and to keep in touch with all our affiliates in the region and for them also to know what PSI has been doing globally, regionally, and sub-regionally. And a lot of information have been really posted on our website, regional and the global. And a lot of efforts have been put in place by our PSI General Secretary, Sister Rosa, and also Comrade Babaye. And in also same vein, a new staff has been employed to take care of global campaign and advocacy. He will also soon be joining us in this program and also subsequent programs. Comrades, like I mentioned, the essence of this webinar has really elaborated in the question note is to also hear from you because we have really passed through a lot of challenges. And you can see the pandemic and also the vaccine situation are really two extreme situations that in between we have faced a lot of problems. And definitely when you listen to Rosa, you will know clearly what PSI has been able to do over the last few months, I mean many months. We have not been resting, and God thank God we have also survived the COVID. Many of us have really been infected and they survived it, though many also have lost their lives. And we pray that their souls will rest in perfect peace, and also may their families also have the fortitude to bear that great loss. So, comrades, I want to welcome you, but definitely most of the talk will be done by our General Secretary, Sister Rosa, who has a lot to share with you, so that, again, after speech, you definitely need to go back to our website and see a lot of effort that have been done and also posted there. So, comrades, my leader, Savita, and comrades, welcome once again. So I hand over back the floor to you to invite Rosa formally. Thank you, comrades.
Thank you, comrades, Regional Secretary, Comrade Sani Baba. Indeed, we were caught unexpected. We thought 2020-2021 will be doing a great movement in terms of representing our members, but now we are finding ourselves having to work remotely, hence we are having webinars, no more physical meetings, and it's very difficult. We are losing touch with our members, but we want to thank you, PSI, for making these platforms so that we keep our connection with our members, so that their members can know that we are still representing them, though they cannot see us physically now. at the workplace, but we are there to represent them. Let me welcome the General Secretary of PSI, Rosa Pavanelli. GS, you may take the floor. I know that you've got a lot to say to our members and to the public at large, because I believe that even the public will be watching this because they've got the hope that the health workers will take them out of the misery that they are having. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sister Rita, and also thank you very much for all what you are doing in South Africa, dealing with such a terrible and difficult situation. Maybe we can remove the agenda so we can see each other. And yes, indeed, as Sister Rita said, we were all hoping that in 1 year time we could have solved this situation, but it's now clear, I think, to everyone that COVID is here and is here to stay for a long period. We are in a limited number with many comrades that are staff or members of our constitutional bodies. So I think it's better to use this time to talk about the work that we have done, the challenges that we have ahead, and how we want to move. As we are all perfectly aware of the dramatic situation that workers in the health and care services are facing, and also other first line and emergency workers have been doing. You know that since the very beginning, we have been the first organization to launch and I think also that we need in this discussion that we are going to have not only to highlight the difficulties, but also the steps ahead that we have been able to promote, to push with our initiatives. We have been the first in the global trade union movement, first of all, to call on the necessity to invest in quality public services to protect workers and to increase the number of staff in all health facilities and care facilities where we saw that tough and hard working conditions, a lack of protections for workers, were causing thousands and thousands of infections, and what we know only with the formal statistics that we have that are very limited in reality. 70,000 health workers died in the past year because of the pandemic. But I am afraid that is underestimating the number of workers that have been not only affected, but who died because of COVID, because it doesn't take into consideration all the care workers in elder house facilities, long-term care facilities, and it doesn't take into account the reality of the community health workers that have been facing bare hands the first response in many remote areas and rural communities. So it's a tragedy, and it's a massacre of health workers that we had to face. Nevertheless, we work to support our affiliates in their fight for the claim of protection and fairer working conditions. Many of our affiliates have been able to negotiate better conditions for workers, as well as negotiating working conditions for all those who had to start working from home, with home working from remote. This is not the whole picture. This is not the whole picture as always it is, because in many cases we saw that our affiliates had to face had to fight to have their right recognized, and they were not always successful. We know that in many places workers were suffered retaliation because of the protests that they organized in order to get their fundamental rights recognized. And we also know that in many cases there's been no response from the authorities to the workers' claim. At the same time, and this is part of the work that BABA has been following very closely with the WHO, we have been engaged in several committees within the WHO in order to ensure that health workers can enjoy better working conditions, and that the policies that governments were adopting to face the pandemic were responding also to the need to involve workers in that process. At the same time, we engaged with the ILO. We worked on the issue of occupational health and safety, on the issue of extending the notion of COVID-19 as a professional disease to be recognized to all the workers that are in contact with patients that are in frontline activities, I would say, and for sure for health workers. Part of this work is now the objective of the survey that the ILO is developing on Convention 149 on nursing and relative resolution. I forget the number now, but Baba will remember it for sure. We are in the process with the involvement of our affiliates and with meetings that are going to be held region by region to organize a collective response to this survey in order to make sure that all the claims of our members are included and the perspective of our members are included within the review of that convention. I must say that the most successful part of our work, which doesn't mean that we are the winner yet, refers to the fact that we have been very vocal, and I would say very bold, in claiming a deep change in the economic structure of our global system. As we saw that privatization, PPPs, innovative financing, mixed financing, To be short, the Addis Ababa agenda on financing for development are part of the root causes of this tragedy. From one hand, it's now clear that there's a close connection between climate crisis, the irresponsible use of natural resources and of pollution with the spread of these new viruses. And on the other hand, we saw that where services, public services, have been curtailed by years and years of austerity policies, of neoliberal policies, of budget cuts, and public services have been the object of austerity policies, of structural programs, of cuts, to be short, cuts in funding and staffing of the services with the different forms, PPPs, privatization, commodification, marketization, whatever we want to call it. Well, the capacity to respond to the pandemic has been much, much worse than in the few examples that we have where, on the contrary, governments invested in public services. And it seems now that in the global narrative, this is, you know, a common discourse. However, it's not yet clear if the real intention is to invest public money or to push even more the role of private capitals in the health and care sector. We used different tools to tackle these issues. Investigation in the tax attitude of some of the biggest corporates in the, for instance, in the care sector, where we could get evidence that all those who were responsible, those corporates who were responsible, that were responsible of tax evasion, were at the same time those who were not respecting workers' rights, treating workers very badly, and at the same time having a high rate of deaths among workers and patients as well. And this helped us to launch a campaign naming and shaming companies that were responsible for that. We produced for the first time, along with some of our allies, included the Trans Tax Justice Network and the Global Alliance for Tax Justice, the first report on the state of tax globally, where we have been able to show how much money has been stolen or is stolen every year by illicit flows to tax havens, and how much it corresponds to the capacity of state to fund their fundamental public services. As you know, the UN approved a five-year plan for the health sector in 2016 as a consequence of the high-level commission that the UN General Secretary nominated. At the time, President Zuma was one of the co-chairs of the commission, where it was stated that 18 million health workers were needed within 2030 to respond to the fundamental needs of the global population. Nothing has been done so far in that direction to implement those decisions that were adopted by the OECD, by the ILO, by the WHO, by the global community, to be short. And we found out that with the illicit flow of money to tax havens that is lost every year, we could fund 34 million nurses per year, more, the double of what would be needed according to the five-year plan. And this is something shocking, and this is something that we need to expose to the authorities, given that it shows that it's possible to respond to the need of staff, and it's not something impossible that require private capitals. It requires private capitals, yes, but capitals that comes from taxation and that are the first responsibility of government. This is why we went even more, insisted even more on PSI positions that it's time to introduce a global tax on corporate that we esteemed to be equal to 25% of for corporates that they have to pay everywhere that they establish their business. This is even more important now that we see how much money, how much profit health, big pharma and high tech companies have been able to put in their pockets during this year, and we expect to do even more in future. And I think that we need to be proud of the fact that our insistency has pushed ahead a global discussion. It's not, hello?
Hi.
We can still hear
you. We can
you.
Hear.
Yes, we can hear you very well.
And you can see me?
Yes, we can see you.
Yeah. Yep.
We can hear you, we can see you very well.
I mean, I lost you, I can't see you, but it's important that you can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you, we can see you.
And I think that it is important, it is important, sorry, here I am. It is important that we highlight the fact that now this issue is top on the global agenda. It's something that was completely unexpected, and nobody could hope only few months ago that the President of the United States was going to question the Washington consensus and put this issue of a global tax on corporate on the table for the discussion of the G20 and the global community. And I think that we need to recognize that the work that we have been doing trying to move and to promote a global community with many allies to push in that direction contributed to highlight the inconsistency, or better to say, the failure of a system that is awarding corporates that are making trillions, billions, billions, if not trillions of profit at the expenses of ordinary people and workers. And the second thing I want to highlight is our campaign on the waiver on the WTO TRIPS agreement. The WTO TRIPS agreement recognizes the value of intellectual properties for companies for the patents of their production. And it also refers to big pharma and pharmaceutical productions. This is what it has always been done. But we need to say that the TRIPS agreement includes a clause that allows for a waiver in case of public health disaster emergency. And if a pandemic is not an emergency, I'm wondering what an emergency, health emergency can be. The WHO Director General called on the use of the waiver some months ago now, and asking to the global community to promote that. The Indian government, the South African government, along with many other governments from the global south were supporting that claim and presented a resolution in that direction to the WTO. But the resolution encountered the fierce opposition of the G20 countries and the most richest countries. A breach is now opening in that opposition front. There are governments within the G20 that start realizing that this is no longer sustainable. But of course it requires a decision of all the G20 countries to promote the waiver. This will allow all the countries who have the facilities able to produce the vaccine to use the know-how, the patent to produce vaccines that will be enough to respond to the needs of the global population. At the same time, being able not having to pay for the patent to the big pharma. We need to recognize that big pharma in many cases vaccine have been developed with lots of public investment, public money investment, taxpayers investment. So it's not at all acceptable that they developed the vaccine with public money, but now they want to make their private profit with those fundings. And I also think that we need to stress on the fact that with the multiplying of variants in different countries, it's becoming absolutely necessary to vaccinate all the population to reduce the possibility that the variants will spread further the contagion with more aggressively, as it happened in South Africa, as it's happening in India and Brazil, and we see in many other countries, in the UK and in many other countries. And at the same time, we need to realize that in a globalized world, it's impossible to stop a virus unless you vaccinate all the population. So it's not protecting, the interest of the big pharma that we can find a solution to this. Well, I said there's the opposition of the G20, but it's now growing, the movement, including many authorities, Nobel laureates, politicians, academics, that are putting pressure on the G20 countries and on the WTO to promote this waiver for vaccine. Just one comment on that, and then I stop here, and I let and I will be able to talk with you to intervene later, or to respond to your question, or to contribute to the general debate. Only one thing I want to comment. Recently, the ITUC Africa released a statement where they were calling on the international community to support the COVAX program that is promoted by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, along with some rich countries and companies putting some money in order to give a certain amount of jabs of vaccines to the poorest country. That was the first response that was put together by the international community, but in any case, this is a response that aimed to protect the interest of pharmaceutical corporates from one hand, and from the other hand, to allow the richest countries, the northern rich country, to select those countries they want to partner to benefit of the vaccine. And the quantity of the vaccine available is not at all sufficient to cover the needs of a whole population in the selected country. It sounds strange to me. I commented this with Sunny, because we are pushing for a global solution that is based on justice and equity, not on charity and on philanthropic approach that will continue to keep the southern countries of the world, and particularly Africa, in a situation of colonial submission, I would say, and this is not at all acceptable in our perspective. Also considering that more or less in all the continent there are facilities that can be used to produce vaccine and quality vaccines to respond to the needs of all. So I think we need to be clear. We need also to open a debate with the national centers and with ITUC Africa on this issue, as this is the time to put pressure on the international community to make a real deep change. And we have the chance to promote some change, but we need to be very firm in the claims that we want to promote. As a last note I saw yesterday, just to comment, because this is part also of the work that Sunny is doing in Africa, that UCLG, the Association of Local Governments, the Global Association for Local Governments, released a statement supporting the waiver of the TRIPS, the WTO TRIPS. So is another area of work where we can build alliances to push together with some of our social partners. I stop here, and I think I have covered the topics, the most important things. Then we can discuss all the other things, and also Baba and other will contribute.
Thank you, GS, and thank you very much for setting a tone for this webinar by giving us the detailed report of what PSI is doing in the fight for a sustainable global solution to the COVID-19. Indeed, what will be the crisis in health, in our social environment, if COVID-19 is not a crisis? We have noted that there is a step back, not a few steps back, or many steps back in us attaining the sustainable development goals. All of them, 17 of them, they are affected now. I don't want to mention them one by one, but I'm telling you everything. It looks like we are not going to reach, or we are not going to attain the sustainable developmental goals. But where I am now with the program, I'm going to call up the speakers now, but I want just to remind the speakers that our webinar objectives were to understand how the vaccine works, the importance of vaccination, the effectiveness of vaccines that have been produced so far. We also wanted you to reflect on the danger of the big pharma and the vaccine apartheid. We also need to hear from you, how can we then intensify the campaign for TRIPS waiver? We were trying to create a platform of sharing of experience from different countries of this sub-region, and also to reflect on the possible trade union responses towards COVID-19. Those are the objectives that will be covered by the speakers as well as the participants in this webinar. Comrade, I'll call you comrade. I think you don't mind, Dr. Hopa Kumar, if I call you a comrade. We are on item 2, the topic that has been submitted to you is to how vaccines can contain the pandemic and the choices we have against the COVID-19. We believe that the vaccines are the solutions to contain this pandemic. But also, we don't know whether to call them fake news, but you'll tell us if they are fake news. About the vaccines. There are people that are against the vaccination. There are myths of 5Gs. There are myths around I don't know whether it's myth or not, the side effects of the vaccines, but we'll hear from you. Dr. Hopa Kumar from the Third World Network, he's also a lawyer working with TWN. Over to you, sir. I hope that you clarify all our concerns around the vaccines as to how can these vaccines assist. We know that we had other pandemics before, the Spanish flu, the measles, the polio, to mention the few, and we do have vaccines, but this one, when we got the vaccines, there were lot of negative stories about the vaccines. So we'll hear from you. Please take the floor.
Thank you. Thank you, dear friend, Rita. And let me just start sharing my presentation. So let me start with my second slide. So how does COVID vaccine 19 really works? So one of the important criticism people talk about vaccine, COVID vaccine, is that it does not prevent infection. So I had vaccination and next day I became COVID positive, or our friends had vaccine, then even a few days later they became COVID positive. So this is coming from our perception about the vaccine. Over the years, most of our vaccines we are using, the main purpose of the vaccination is to prevent the infection. But this COVID vaccines, the main purpose is not to prevent the infection. It may help in the prevention of transmission of COVID, but it does not prevent. It is not made to prevent the infection. It is made to prevent the severity of the infection. To explain it further, the COVID infection first affects our respiratory tract. So the COVID vaccine actually protect our systems from infection. So as a result, you will still get the infection, but it will prevent to affect our lungs or other organs. So that's the way the COVID vaccine works. So the aim of the COVID vaccine is to prevent the severity of the infection. So once you prevent the severity of the infection, the run for hospital, etc., will really get reduced and the severity goes down. In order to achieve this at a, from a public health, we will always talk about the population coverage. And at least they are saying there should be 70% of the population coverage, at least if not 100%. So you need around 70 to 80% population coverage to feel the, to witness the effectiveness of the vaccine. And now more and more new variants are coming in. Vaccine makers are saying that we may require booster doses. Unlike the smallpox vaccine, with one single shot, you get lifetime immunity. Or a yellow fever vaccine, one shot, you get 10 years of immunity. But this vaccine, we do not know exactly with after two shots how long our immunity is going to last. And if new variants are coming in, then we may require a booster dose. Even sometimes some people are predicting we may require like a flu vaccine, an annual vaccination, but we don't know yet. So I'm not getting into that area. And there is small clarification about the efficacy of the vaccine. Efficacy of the vaccine is that how the vaccine is protecting an individual. Okay. But the effectiveness of the vaccine is that that's the effect of vaccine within a one population. So this both are slightly different, and the vaccine so far claiming, so that takes me to the next slide. We have around 14 vaccines are approved by various regulatory agencies in the world. So these vaccines' efficacy varies from vaccine to vaccine. We have Pfizer and Moderna around 95% efficacy. Sputnik V claims around 91% efficacy. Then there are various vaccines, Johnson around 81 or 83%. AstraZeneca is claiming around 71%. So we have these various efficacy claims are made. But these claims, when we say 95% of efficacy, we are under a misconception always, thinking that if the vaccine is administered on 100 people, 95% people will be safe, and 5% of the people have the chance of getting infected. So that's not true. This is individuals. Okay, so you like to say that 95% efficacy means 95% chances are there you will not get in severity of the infection. So that is what we like to understand. And now the data is coming. After vaccination, you have a very substantial percentage of cutting down chance of infection. Plus, you have almost 95 to 80% of the 95% even to 100% range of not even though you get the get infected, but you may not get a severity of the infection. So the efficacy here means it's basically at the individual level. Just keep that in mind. And as I told you, there are 14 vaccines approved so far. Out of that, this 14 is, we need to be little careful about these 14 numbers, because AstraZeneca vaccine approved in by different manufacturers also sometimes get counted. So that way, the WHO has a emergency use listing. That basically means to facilitate the international procurement of vaccines. So till now, only 3 vaccines from 5 manufacturers were approved. These are Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, and AstraZeneca. But AstraZeneca vaccine produced in South Korea, AstraZeneca vaccine produced in India, both are also got emergency use listing. So we have around 5 vaccines from 3 manufacturers. Sorry, 3 vaccines from 5 manufacturers are approved by the WHO as part of the emergency use listing. So this means these vaccines are available for international procurement to COVAX facilities and the countries who are eligible under the Gavi program. Those countries can get, and Gavi has created a COVAX facility to facilitate free access to around Gavi eligible countries, around 92 countries. So these vaccines are in various technology platforms, but except Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, all other vaccines are on existing technology platforms. That means there are vaccines using the same techniques. And we should also keep in mind that this vaccine technology is around 140 years old. This technology, the concept of vaccine, irrespective of the technology platform, has not changed. The vaccine can create some kind of side effects, but that is not coming from the vaccine material per se, but the materials you use to deliver the vaccine. So very large number of people, the vaccine side effects are by and large on the area of injection, and then some people, as we have read, in the case of there are a chance of blood clots, etc., but a very, very minute number. So the cost always is lesser than the benefit. That's why the regulatory authorities have not withdrawn these vaccines from the market, and they allow to vaccinate. With all these ifs and buts, why the vaccination in the COVID context makes sense? As I told you, it reduced the reduction of severity of the infection. Second, so as a result, very less number of people require to go to the hospital or require hospitalization. So that will in a way reduces the stress on the health system. And eventually that lead to bring back, because the once the infection became a kind of a normal, very less feverish or, less infectious, then, you can bring back to the socio-economic life, or you can you can bring some degree of normalcy in the socio-economic life. So that is what's happening in Israel and UK. Even in US, announced the other day that if you have 2 shots of vaccine, even you don't have to wear masks. So this is the way the countries who are having substantial number of percentage of vaccination completed is moving. So therefore, the vaccination makes sense. That also is a public, is a good investment from a government's physical discipline are concerned. Because somebody may argue that why government should spend for vaccine? People, we don't have money. How do we buy vaccine for the people? But I think it does make a sense, because it can bring back to the socio-economic life, back to the normalcy. So the investment you make really is actually beneficial for the people. So that's why vaccine as well as vaccination are considered as a public good. So many people, when President Macron, when Chancellor Angela Merkel, even the World Health Assembly resolution, World Health Assembly resolution termed vaccination as a public good, but other people, as you see on my slide, they called vaccine as a public good, including the UN Secretary General termed COVID vaccine as a public good. But of course, having said or having termed vaccine as a public good, but realizing or translating this concept into day-to-day life is difficult, and we are finding a lot of gap what these leaders promised and what's really happening. So here see, so a few countries account for the substantial percentage of the vaccination. There are around till date 1.6 billion doses were administered. Out of that, around 70% concentrated in a few countries. For example, in the slide, you can see that around 232 million doses in USA, 229 in China, 147 million doses in India, and EU is around 134. So altogether, this will be roughly 70%, I think, of the total doses administered so far. So there is a concentration of vaccination. What are the reason for this concentration? This concentration is primarily due to a few countries are either purchasing or book the vaccination. As you might have read, 16% of the countries who are having, mainly high-income countries, having 16% of the global population has acquired more than 53% of the vaccine doses, or they booked the 53% of the vaccine doses to be produced in 2021. Then countries like China and India, they do have the manufacturing capability to produce huge number of vaccine, and therefore they could also administer their population. But what we should keep it in mind, though China and India is leading with 229 and 147 million doses, to compare it with the percentage of the population, these doses are nothing. So in India's case, I can tell you the only 22 million people out of this 147 doses, only 22 million people have completed two doses of vaccine. So that means around 1.65% of the vaccine. And you have to achieve at least 70% of the population coverage. With this speed, it may take years to complete. So why is it so happening? But if you look at many other countries, their population coverage as well as the number of doses are very low. So that means there is a huge demand, but there is less supply. So availability is an issue, and price is also an issue. Price varies from $2 to $40. You might have read AstraZeneca supplied vaccine to Uganda at, I think, $7 per dose. So this much huge price variation of the same vaccine is happening. Same AstraZeneca supplied around $1.73 to the European Union. So we need a huge scaling up of the production to meet the huge demand. There is a huge unmet demand. And companies who are having, as I told you, 14 vaccines have been approved by various agencies, and many more vaccines are to come. But there is a huge gap. These companies alone cannot meet the demand. And according to IFPMA, the Global Association of the Big Pharmaceutical Companies, even if all the vaccine which are supposed to obtain marketing approval and produces all the doses as per their plan, still you are short of around 2 billion doses. No, at least you can calculate is that it's a global population and 70% of the population and needed two doses of vaccine. So that means around 12 billion doses you require. But all the production which here goes as per the plan, still you will have only around 10 billion doses. So this is what the IFPMA says, and we are forced to, take that truth, because around July or September 2020, around 800 million doses were promised, by the end of March. But we know that, you know, only a fraction of that has been actually came into the market. So that takes us to the what really preventing us from doing scaling up the production, because the TNCs firms and developed countries are not ready to give up the control on the technology, because they say that it's their investment and it cannot be shared so easily. You might have come across an interview broadcasted yesterday where Bill Gates rejecting the idea of sharing the vaccine formulas. Having said this, how much truth is there? And I also told you that we are taming vaccine as a global public good, and I cited the reasons for that. But why we say it's a vaccine as an vaccine is a public good, and it needs to be shared, because the vaccine is the outcome of research and development. And who funded this research and development? The data shows that $93 billion were spent on vaccine research and development by the government. Okay, there is only less percentage of the private sector money. For instance, AstraZeneca, 97% of the AstraZeneca vaccine is financed by the public sector. Moderna vaccine, 100% is financed by the public sector. Wow. Pfizer vaccine, though they say that they don't receive the money, but they did receive $2 billion from the government as an advanced market commitment. And the BioNTech, which developed the technology, received around 300 million plus assistance from the German government. So there is a heavy involvement of public sector money or public money, and the moment the public money is there, it's owned by the public that way. So it is not their private money and private investment. So therefore, public has a legitimate claim on the outcome of the research. So that's why we also call it as a public good. Develop this vaccine using public money. They are not ready to share the technology to the potential manufacturers in order to scale up the vaccine production. The scaling up is very critical, because you need to achieve that 70% of the population coverage the quickest span of time. Otherwise, you may not have the desired effect, or you may lose the effect of vaccination. I know people normally tell that nobody is safe until everybody is safe. Okay, so therefore, it is important that considerable, substantial percentage of the population get the vaccination at the shortest possible time. So then only we have hope go back to the pre-COVID days. And especially in the absence of any medicines. We do not have a medicine to treat COVID till date. Okay, so the best tool currently available in our hand is a vaccine. And the access of that vaccine prevented by the monopoly, the desire for monopoly by the vaccine manufacturers. Normally, they use two types of intellectual property rights to control power on the vaccine technology. Using one is patent, and another is trade secret. Patent, all of you know that. I'm not spending any time on that. The trade secret, to speak quickly, trade secret is unlike the other medicines. When you produce vaccine, the regulatory agency insists that you follow the exact method of manufacturing developed by the originator company. If you don't follow, you have to prove the safety and efficacy again. So as a result, a company who wants to produce the same vaccine as the best option is to go to the originator company and seek the technology. If the technology is denied, then they have to develop their own technology, but then they have to carry out clinical trials to prove the safety and efficacy of the vaccine. That is time consuming, and that is also require resources. So as a result, companies always are reluctant to reverse engineer the vaccines, because there is no incentive for them to do so. Because the moment you do that, you have to spend additional money. So it is better to obtain a license and produce the vaccine. So unlike patent, there is no compulsory licensing mechanism to share the trade secret. However, there is a mechanism wherein which the government can help. Probably the regulatory agencies can help because they do have this information. They can share this information with the potential manufacturers and nudge them to produce the vaccine at the quickest possible time and to bring a kind of level playing field between the originator vaccine manufacturers and the non-originator vaccine manufacturers. But you cannot share that dossiers as of now because the TRIPS agreement prevents you from doing it. It does say, you know, from a legal perspective, you can say you can still share. It's the TRIPS agreement say that you can share the dossiers to protect the public. But in what circumstances you are protecting the public, nobody knows that. Okay, so that will be interpreted by the WTO's dispute settlement board. So there is a legal uncertainty the moment you take this information and give somebody to produce a vaccine. So this creates a legal uncertainty. So as a result, nobody is ready to share. So here comes the TRIPS waiver. The TRIPS waiver will help and clarify the position that the countries have the freedom, the regulatory authorities have the policy space to share that dossiers, to promote the vaccine production, to meet the demand, and that way you can contain the spread of the disease. So that is where the importance of TRIPS waiver in the context of vaccine. Otherwise, why I am saying is that, you know, normally the vaccine manufacturers, European Union and US blocks till now oppose the adoption of the waiver proposal, citing two reasons. One is, oh, if you do that, it undermines the innovation. As I told you, how the innovation takes place. Innovation takes place through the R&D funding. And in this case, the R&D funding is actually done by the government, not by the private company. If the R&D funding is done by the private companies and then you are taking away without a compensation, that does make sense. Okay, you can say that, okay, it undermines my investment. But here there is no such thing happens because it is substantially funded by the private, by the public sector. And second argument, they say that in the case of vaccine, they say, look, you cannot produce a vaccine only with a compulsory license of patents, but you also need the technology transfer, which I told you. The problem is that the regulatory agencies insist that you follow the manufacturing process of the originator. Otherwise, you have to carry out the clinical trials. But this can be bypassed. Either by sharing the dossier of the originator to the regulatory to the non-originator company by the regulators, or regulatory agency can develop a mechanism wherein which the non-originator vaccine can be approved without a clinical trial. So we are living in the era of vaccine monopoly, and which is resulting people's health. And it undermines our ability to effectively, undermines many of our government's ability to respond to the vaccine, to the pandemic. And it in a way undermines the state's capacity to contain the pandemic. So this is a major issue. And the TRIPS waiver proposal got substantial support from various corners, including the lawmakers, even 400 lawmakers of the European Parliament. A member of European Parliament extended their support. And similarly, the lawmakers in the US also wrote to the President Biden to support the waiver proposal. So, and Nobel laureate Rosa told you already, around 100 plus Nobel laureates or former heads of the state also wrote a letter to Biden asking for the waiver. So there is a massive support. The people are supporting this proposal. And by way of conclusion, we need to realize or translate the idea of a global public good, vaccine as a global public good, into reality. Okay? And we should, for that purpose, we should put an end to the COVID vaccine monopoly and to ensure availability and access, that is through the diversification of the production base of vaccine. And we also need to build our capacities at the national level and regional level of vaccine production, so we can meet the not only this crisis, also the crisis which may come up in the future. So therefore, I think we need to work with the like-minded groups and movements in the coming days. So thank you.
We really appreciate your contribution in this webinar. Indeed, moreover, the health workers, when everybody ran for hiding at the beginning of this pandemic, health workers could not run away because they cannot work remotely. Mm-hmm. Their only prayer was this vaccine, that if we could get the vaccine, then things would be better. It was very painful, or it is still painful, for the health workers to wheel out their colleagues from the hospital to the mortuaries. And our hopes is that this vaccine will reach each and every health worker. You correctly said that the it's not going to prevent the infection. I think we are still going to emphasize on non-pharmaceutical prevention, the PPEs and the likes. But indeed, if we could get the vaccine, it could prevent the severity and it could minimize the number of deaths. Thank you very much. Let me take another speaker, a comrade, an activist, Comrade Baba Ayi. We have already heard from the General Secretary that PSI has called for the WTO TRIPS waiver. We believe in PSI that we should put human life first and we should put human life over profit. Can you tell us about this campaign and also what are you seeking to achieve and what is it that motivated PSI to take this call? I know. Once you talk about apartheid, I know what you're talking about because I'm from South Africa. And if the vaccine now is going to be termed a vaccine apartheid, that means poor countries are in trouble. Baba Aye, please take the floor.
Thank you very much, Comrade Titular, Comrade Rita, and thanks to all, thanks to the sub-region for the excellent idea of organizing this webinar. The General Secretary, Comrade Rosa Pavanelli, has made my work easier in terms of speaking to even a number of what you have raised, Rita, and my very good friend Gopal, good to see you. It's been a while too. I'll try contextualize the questions Comrade Rita has asked me to look into, partly because it needs some context to look at things. And it's very important, our struggle for universal, for people's vaccine, universal access to the vaccine. It is of exceeding importance because the vaccine right now is an important link in the chain. And while we hold that, because it's important to hold the most important link in the chain at each point in time, we must not lose sight of the chain as a whole, because the issue of the vaccine apartheid, or some would even say vaccine imperialism, the issue of putting intellectual property over and above the health of billions of people, they are all tied into a systemic rhythm of neoliberalism. As we campaign against this, this is a crisis, like Arundhati Roy said, is a portal. You know, how we come out after this depends on how we blend our short-term and long-term demands at each point in time in this struggle to fight for to reorder the rules on the basis of which the world functions. It is instructive to start at this point in time from Jonas Salk, who was who invented the polio vaccine, who developed the polio vaccine in 1953. When he was asked if he would who would own the patent of the vaccine, he said, "Can you patent the sun? That it belongs to the people, to everyone." We all know how that singular work of his has been able to save millions, tens of millions of children from polio. So, but the thing is, in that period, up till the 1990s, you didn't have, in a sense, a global regime of patents like this. It was essentially the stronger countries. Now you're talking of even making compulsory licenses seem to be a big deal. In that period, that is before the mid-1990s, you had the United States itself carry out several compulsory licensing, no issue. Between 1969 and 1992, Canada carried out compulsory licensing, I think 613 compulsory licensing, no issue. One of the companies that fought against government using compulsory licensing in this period is Pfizer, which is also a major culprit, a major villain in what is happening right now with the COVID-19 vaccine. And this was in the 1960s when it took the British government to court for compulsory licensing for drugs for the National Health Service, the NHS. Things changed in 1995 with the emergence of the World Trade Organization. However, and this is important for us to, in looking at what we are doing now, the background to it, it's not only the WTA that was formed in 1995. UNAIDS, the United Nations AIDS Program, was also formed in 1995, because this was also a period where you had the HIV AIDS pandemic spreading like wildfire. And you know, but now with the WTO, you know, a global architecture for foisting the hegemony of intellectual property rights on everybody. So, just as of now, it was India, South Africa took the gauntlet as developing countries that fought for, look, we are people, this is having great impact. We cannot go along with this strict, constricting global intellectual property rights order that is being foisted on us, you know. But the company, because as at that time, we then had highly active antiretroviral therapy, which, you know, with the use of three different ARVs, but these were costing between $10,000 to $15,000 per person per annum, you know. So and it was not sustainable in the poorer countries. But and that is this is very important in inspiring us. You see, there were mass mobilization struggle by social movements, developing countries, and with this organizing power and institutional struggle, changes were brought about. When I heard of Biden's seeming readiness now for to support the TRIPS waiver campaign, I was happy, but it gave me a flashback because similarly in 2000, you had Bill Clinton show his weight behind sub-Saharan African countries using compulsory licensing. But, and this is also important to where we are now, Bill Clinton did not just make that declaration, even passed an executive order, I think 13155, for that purpose. But it was because of mass action by unions, by social movements, and also advocacy by developing countries within the WTO. So, because May 2000, when he said this was just some 5 months after the Seattle struggle stopped the WTO in the United States and all that. And part of this was against the hegemony of intellectual property rights. Fast forward now, because one of the main things we are using is the WTO TRIPS waiver built into the waiver possibilities built into TRIPS for public health purposes that came out of the Doha round in 2001. But this also reflected both these two, working on these two legs of social movement activism and advocacy within government. Now, to where we are, PSI, as Rosa rightly pointed out, has been at the fore, not even only for before even we got to the vaccines, in an excellently articulated perspective of our priorities and perspective on the pandemic, with the General Secretary, put together right at the very early days of the pandemic. It pointed out that, look, there was the need to suspend patents on medicines, technologies, medical supplies that were needed to combat the pandemic. This includes vaccine. And right now, vaccines are of exceeding importance. And as I said, the most important link in the chain. But it is a comprehensive position about what should be the stance in situations of pandemic. Because how we come out of this will also set the rules on the basis of which the global response to subsequent pandemics. And mind you, as several people, including the WHO Director General, Dr. Tedros, has pointed out, we are likely going to be having several pandemics in the coming period. And it is also partly based on the global architecture that is based on putting the profit of a handful of people before the health of the earth and the billions of people. So the thing is that we're talking about this, but coming, because as I said, is the key link and due to time now. On the COVID-19 vaccines in particular, we as PSI, we have carried out several advocacy written and working along with a number of civil society organizations in several networks, including the People's Vaccine Alliance, including with TW, including with Amnesty, but with our affiliates and the head office. As arrowhead of the work we are doing, we have written to several governments. We have, and right now the good thing is you have about 100 countries supporting the waiver. You have some of these for want of a better word, like the belly of the beast, the United States, our affiliates take key role in also, canvassing for this in Britain, in Europe, Germany, France, within the EU. Our affiliates have, working along with the body of the PSI as a whole, hammered on the need for their governments to reverse their stance of support for intellectual property rights and rather to switch over to supporting this TRIPS waiver. And I must commend the African region for one thing, because one would not really think that, well, I mean, regions in the developing world would automatically support the call for waiver, but it was not necessarily so. There were a few countries within the African region that initially we are not in support of the campaign for a waiver, for several reasons. We don't need to go into this that now. But PSI, working closely with its affiliates on the ground in these countries, reached out to the government, carried out consistently advocacy with the government. This contributed very significantly to to where we are now, that the Africa as a bloc is solidly behind the waiver, the call for a waiver. And as we struggle for this, to point out some of the reasons why, as the emphasis is on the vaccine, we should have all eyes open. Even before we got to the stage of the vaccines, when you had things like 3D printing of ventilator parts in a country like Italy during the surge, you had the companies that had the patent right to it threatening to take people to court. When people were, when there was, there was not enough ventilators, there were not enough PPEs, the PPSI was at the fore of calling out, you know, on the global crisis within the global public emergency itself, of the shortages of PPEs. As way back as March last year, the PSI General Secretary wrote to the Director General of the WHO calling for action in this regard. So we have to see how all this fit together. Now, as I pointed out, these issues, there are technical dimensions of them and which are quite important, but they are primarily political. You know, they are primarily political and about the priorities that governments, that world leaders, you know, place on people, place on health as against, you know, profits and the wealth of a few people. So, and when you talk about it being political and structural, the issue of Rosa spoke exceedingly on that, where you have a situation where you have some 47 trillion in tax havens, amounts that could cover the monies needed to recruit nurses and health workers to fill the 18 million shortage twice over. When you have situations like this, you can see that there are more issues. So the things about, not only about tax justice, the issue about the debts, a lot of these are even obvious debts. The debts of less developed countries have to be cancelled to enable them. There's the need for governments to have the fiscal policy space, you know, to be able to, because beyond this vaccine, the issue of part of the team here is also about universal access to healthcare. The greatest preparedness, because right now a lot of things about crisis preparedness and response, investment in quality public health, universal public health and care systems is the surest way of, you know, ensuring preparedness, you know. So without fiscal policy space, this is impossible for several countries. We cannot rest on charity. As a South African delegate pointed out to the last WTO meeting, that look, the problem with charity is that it says to hell with rights, you know. And talking of rights, the rights of people, also the people, the issue of countries. Rosa spoke about COVAX, and a key thing to point out there as well, in addition to what she has pointed out, is how through several corner directions and ways of maneuvers, you see corporations taking decisive decision, being inculcated into institutions of decision making in the name of what they call multi-stakeholderism. They now make themselves, they put maybe small change. About 90% of the money that have been raised so far on ACT Accelerator, which is the public-private, global public-private partnership that COVAX is a part of. But this is from public funds, just as with the vaccines we're talking about. But yet, for private interests, play the role of dictating that no, let us, there's need for innovation, there's a lot of bad adas. Pardon my French. So the thing is, we have to curtail it. People like Bill Gates Foundation and so on and so forth, they contribute significantly to this. We have to insist on multilateralism because it's about, just as we're talking of public services in the countries, we are against public-private partnership, which has been used to hollow out the place of government as duty bearers. That is what we are seeing at the global level with multi-stakeholderism. We have to take a stand against this. So, coming back home to with regards to the question, to sum up on this, one, the need for a tax waiver cannot be overemphasized. We can win this only through a two-legged form of struggle, that is our advocacy, and getting allies within, working with, you know, governments to ensure that this becomes a generalized position and becomes inevitable as a decision to be made. Three, we have to end multilateralism that is driven by and becomes a part and parcel of the structuralization of neoliberalism in our current period. Four, crisis preparedness is not something that is hanging up there or distinct on its own. It has to be rooted in adequate funding of universal public health and care systems. And post-COVID has already started. You already see the neoliberals, when they talk of building back better and all that, their grammar, they are essentially talking about neoliberalism 3.0 in one way or the other. So the battle on vaccines is itself part of a battle to ensure that we indeed have a better, fairer, and healthier world outside this tunnel as we pass through the COVID-19 portal. Thank you, comrades.
Thank you very much, comrade Baba Aye, the activist. Indeed, we need a healthcare system that is universally, with a universal health care. We normally say access. We all normally emphasize in the access of the healthcare by everyone, whether you are poor or no, you are rich. You should have the same privilege of getting the health, because health is a right. It is a right. And all of us, we need to get an access to it. Comrade Sub-Regional Secretary of South Africa, now that we heard that PSI globally, they've worked very hard to make sure that the vaccine is accessible to everyone. Can you tell us about the rollout of this vaccine in Southern Africa and the acquisition of the vaccine? We heard through other presentations that there are disparities in terms of the access. What is your observation in the Southern Africa? Comrade Fambisa?
Thank you very much, President, and good afternoon, colleagues. And I welcome you again to our webinar, our sub-regional webinar. Initially, we had planned to hold the first webinar on privatization, but because of some issues, we ended up changing the topic to this one. But we still intend to hold that webinar on privatization, and we will announce the date and the rest of the preparations. But it is as well that we are doing this webinar today, because today's webinar on vaccines is coinciding with the week which the World Health Organization has set aside as the commemoration of the World Immunization Week, which started on the 24th to the 30th of April. The previous speakers have demonstrated how vaccination remains our best hope in ending the pandemic. So I will make a presentation on how the vaccination programs in Southern Africa have been rolled out. So to start, I would want to respond to which vaccines have each of the countries in Southern Africa managed to acquire. Through inputs from our colleagues, we attempted to collate information on the vaccines that each country in the sub-region has acquired. Different countries acquired or are in the process of acquiring different vaccines. There are obviously a number of factors that I play in determining which vaccines each country took delivery of. And these factors include access, availability, price, as well as the politics. For example, Swaziland will not be able to acquire vaccines from China due to its close relationship with Taiwan, which China strongly opposes. And similarly, on the issue of politics, South Africa will try to leverage its role in BRICS to acquire a better rate on vaccines manufactured in India. Okay, so that is the table showing the kind of vaccines that the countries in Southern Africa have acquired. But unfortunately, we could not get all the information because some of the colleagues did not submit. But that table there shows a summary of some of the vaccines that have been acquired. Some public health experts claim that humanity has not achieved any herd immunity through a natural disease process to most major infectious diseases that affect the population to the scale of the coronavirus. According to these experts, all the major infections have required vaccination in order to attain herd immunity. In the case of COVID-19, the generally recommended percentage of the population that needs to be vaccinated in order to achieve herd immunity is said to be between 60 and 70%. But some say it's subject to discussion since COVID-19 is a new disease. Unfortunately, the picture so far of the vaccines that have been acquired by Southern African countries does not come anywhere near this figure. It is very, very, very little, as I also explain in my later presentation. On rollout plans, how have the vaccination programs been rolled out? Most countries in the sub-region adopted and conformed to the World Health Organization recommendation to target groups based on local epidemiological information and an assessment of risk factors, as well as the vaccine supply situation in each country. Accordingly, the rollout plans for most Southern African countries were set to take place in two or three phases. Within these phases, there are roughly three categories in which population groups have been prioritized. Firstly, all countries have planned to start vaccinating health workers, who may also include social workers, community health workers, as in the case of Malawi and Namibia. Secondly, countries will vaccinate elderly, often identified as those who are 60 years of age and older, people who live with comorbidities, as well as essential workers such as teachers, cross-border drivers, and workers where social distancing is difficult, like sex workers, retail workers, etc. And lastly, to be vaccinated is the general population that is considered to be generally healthy and who are above 18 years. Malawi has indicated that they intend to vaccinate people as young as 16 years old. So while most countries in the sub-region have drawn up their vaccination plans, the Zambian health minister was quoted as saying that Zambia had delayed setting out a plan for the introduction of COVID-19 vaccines because it needed to ensure that the vaccines were safe and efficacious. Accessibility. I mean, all the previous speakers mentioned that the issue of accessibility remains a problem. And as I have stated earlier on, that the amount of vaccines that have been acquired by Southern African countries is very low. The picture is that the sub-region is getting left behind in the process of vaccinating its population, because almost all the vaccines are manufactured outside the continent. Access to vaccines has been limited as a result of limited stocks and supply bottlenecks of the vaccines. The World Health Organization has rightly identified a lack of supply and inequitable distribution of vaccines as the biggest threat to ending the acute stage of the pandemic and to driving global recovery. It has calculated that Africa has administered vaccines to 13.9 million people, which accounts for only 2% of the global COVID-19 vaccine jabs. So, to put things into perspective, the entire population of the UK is about 67 million, and reports say that they ordered more than 400 million vaccine doses, which is more than three times what it needs. In comparison, the population on the African continent is about 1.3 billion, and by mid-April, African nations had acquired only 34.6 million doses, which is only about 4% of what the continent needs to vaccinate its population. A further illustration of the inequitable distribution of vaccines is that it is estimated that on average, one in four people in high-income countries has received a COVID-19 vaccine, compared with just one in 500 in people in lower-income countries, which includes many African countries. So, to show by way of a table what the situation is like, you can see in that table there, those are countries in the in our sub-region in Southern Africa. And the first column, rather the second column, shows the total number of people who have received at least one dose of a vaccine. The next column shows the total population of each country. And the last column shows the percentage of the population that has received at least one dose. Now, that column does not show the percentage of the population that has been fully vaccinated. It only shows people who have received at least one dose. So the percentage could actually be lower than that. So if you look at those percentages of the population, that is very, very low. And if you compare that to some countries like the U.S., that is say to have already vaccinated about 40% of of their population, and then you compare that to Zambia, which has vaccinated 0.1% of its population, you can see this is extremely low. The only country that seems to be faring better is Mauritius with 9.2%, but of course, still that is very, very low. Some estimates claim that at the rate the vaccinations are going, some Southern African countries would need up to 4,692 days to administer enough doses for another 10% of the population. Unfortunately, should things happen this way, some experts warn that by that time, the current vaccines would be potentially ineffectual against newer strains of the virus that we have developed through mutation. The implications are that there would then be need to develop new vaccines aimed at these particular strains. So these factors are a clear demonstration that Southern Africa is getting left behind in the fight against the coronavirus. And because of this, it faces the danger of what my colleague Baba referred to as COVID apartheid. So what are the obstacles to healthcare in Southern Africa? In terms of vaccine administration, in addition to the limitations of acquiring the vaccines, vaccine rollout programs in some countries have been delayed by operational and financial hurdles or logistical difficulties. For example, South Africa first received a batch of 1 million AstraZeneca doses, which was not effective against the new COVID strain 501V2. It had to halt its rollout program and sold the vaccines to the AU. The doses were subsequently distributed to 18 African countries. Another example of how these financial and logistical issues have affected vaccine administration is when we saw some countries failing to use the doses they had received before they expired. For example, Malawi had to destroy 16,000 doses, Sudan 59,000 doses, and South Africa had to redistribute its thousands of AstraZeneca vaccine doses. Secondly, another obstacle to healthcare in Southern Africa is the issue of poor public healthcare systems. Southern Africa is faced with declining healthcare systems. At the peak of the pandemic in 2020, it became very clear that most countries did not have the capacity to deal with a pandemic. Across the sub-region, from Zimbabwe to Malawi to Swaziland, health workers went on strike for access to PPEs, safe working environments, and for risk allowances. And in addition to this, countries in our sub-region did not have the capacity to conduct COVID-19 tests to the broader population or the equipment to treat patients who were infected with the coronavirus. And the lack of PPEs, oxygen tanks, and ventilators led to numerous deaths of health workers and ordinary citizens. So, what are our recommendations? With limited supplies and delays in vaccine shipment, it is important for Africa to develop its own vaccine manufacturing capacity. According to the World Health Organization, the continent is home to 16% of the world's population, but produces only 0.1% of vaccines. Because African countries largely rely on importation of drugs and vaccines, they are particularly vulnerable to delays in essential health products during the pandemic, as is currently happening with the COVID-19 vaccines. Also, we believe it is time that Africa address the issue of the health crisis in the context of general economic development. Almost all the problems highlighted above hinge on the ability of the African countries to properly industrialize and develop sustainable economies that can manufacture products locally instead of continuing to heavily rely on imports. As trade unions, we need to push for inclusion in policy-making processes so that we can influence national policies and the national agenda. One such area should be the issue of taxes, where we should push for the leveraging of taxes from our resources to fund stronger public services. Thirdly, as Comrade Baba Ai has stated, the trade-related aspects of intellectual property, CHIPS waiver campaign, should be intensified. We encourage all in the sub-region to do more to push and lobby governments to put pressure on intransigent members of the WTO and pharmaceutical companies to waive the TRIPS agreement. And finally, we need to continue to stand strong in protecting our members and workers in general from exploitation through demands for living wages and safe working environments. employers are taking advantage of the pandemic to ride roughshod over the workers. I stop here. Thank you very much. President.
Thank you, Comrade Fambisa. And thank you for the information that you have shared. It's really shocking, the issue of the access to the vaccines. I don't understand why we have to purchase something that is not going to assist us, especially the experience of South Africa with AstraZeneca, because we are all hoping that the supply that was coming in, it was the supply that was going to cover at least the majority of the population. But at the time when we received the vaccines, we also received the news that the vaccines were about to expire before even taking into the rollout. Those are the things that are our worrying factors. But indeed, we do have our own constraints, whether they are politically or by virtue of us being poor and not having money to buy these vaccines. Thank you very much. Let me now go to the fifth item of our program, and open an opportunity for the participants to ask questions. I also have few questions to the speakers. May the speakers listen carefully so that they can respond. And you'll respond by raising your hand. And those who are having questions also, they will raise their hands. Please, Comrade Fambisa, please observe the hands with me so that if I miss one, then you can be able to draw my attention to that hand.
Okay. It's an
there's a hand from Sunny Baba and from the GS. GS?
Sorry, Sister Rita. I have to leave by 2 p.m. as I have another meeting. I want to apologize for that, but I see that it's taking a little bit longer than scheduled, as it was scheduled until 2 p.m.
Yes.
I want to thank you very much, all of you, and particularly Comrade Gopakumar and Fambisa for the presentation. I would like, Fambisa, if you can share the slides you prepare, because this is important material for us to use.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
And I leave you with Sunny and Baba, that I'm sure I'll very able to to respond.
Yeah, thank you, thanks you very much, GS, and thank you for having this time to be with us in this webinar. It really meant a lot, especially for those who don't even know what is PSI. We have highlighted what is the importance of PSI, especially in the public service. Therefore, we would like to appreciate your effort to reach all the countries that are having the affiliates of PSI.
Indeed, thanks to all you and to you particularly, Rita, for the great leadership in the region. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let me take the hand, Comrade Sunny.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks, my leaders, Rita. Mine is just a simple question. Having looked at the presentation just concluded by Comrade Fambisa, I want to take also this opportunity to thank Comrade Babaye, Rosa, and Dr. Gopakumar, Fambisa for the wonderful presentations, which has actually broaden our expectations and also knowledge on what's going on about the vaccines in the entire world and, of course, the region and the sub-region. While introducing Dr. Gopakumar, you asked a question if he could address the issue of fake news about the vaccination, or rather about the vaccines, which is really slowing down the interest of people to really go towards taking, having this vaccination. And also having looked at the presentation made by FAMBISA, the percentage of population that actually have received the vaccine. I want Dr. Gopal Kumar to probably address this issue of fake news, if it has not impacted on the slow or negative perception and towards the populace, because I know what's going on right now in West Africa. The fake news has really taken toll of people's interest, and the people are already scared and afraid that if they take the vaccination, one or two things might happen to them. And for fear of that, they are really discouraging others. Even the enlightened and educated people that we have in the society are really afraid of taking the vaccination. Many people, if you go closer to them, they will tell you they are afraid of taking the vaccination. So probably Dr. Gopal Kumar can also address this issue of fake news, which is really going around through the social media and deterring people from taking the vaccines. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Comrade Sani. Any other hands, Professor?
Yeah, no, thank you, President. Can you hear me?
Yes. Not clear.
Yeah, thank you. I've just got one question from the panelists here. You know, one of our major challenge, probably that has not been touched in the presentation, is the distributions of vaccine into rural areas and other dense areas or in Africa as a whole. How do we deal with that and how do we address that? Because what we have seen, especially here in South Africa, is that distribution of vaccines in the urban areas, it's quite efficient. You know, it's going very smoothly. People need to go to private and get vaccines. You know, the process is very smooth. But I'm more concerned about getting the vaccine to the rural areas where we know that the infrastructure is very poor. There's no proper hospitals there, and also people who are supposed to be giving vaccines. In terms of capacity, we are lacking there. So what can we do, or what can be done to assist the distributions of vaccines to those areas, you know, so that we address the issues of inequality as well? Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Spusiso. Comrade Sadi.
Yes, thank you very much for this. I think let me express my appreciation to PSI in the Southern African region for organizing this webinar. In fact, that's been very interesting. We hope, as you said, Rita, if all the stock could be distributed, circulated to the affiliate in the region, in the sub-region. Now, with respect to Dr. Gopa, the issue of waiver, how successful can we be, you know, with a campaign regarding the waiver, because currently, the issue of vaccine is a very huge problem worldwide. Now we see in Africa, especially developing countries and least developed countries, the problem we are facing. We know India having a lot of problems now, because even ourselves, when we ordered our vaccines, we're not sure whether we'll be receiving those vaccines. Now, the chances of success with respect to waiver. And the second question is regarding the variant, the new variant now. Now, are the people who actually got vaccinated COVID-19, how far are they going to be, of course, taking into account that vaccine prevent the severity of the infection? Now, we've got new variant coming now, the new one coming in South Africa, India, or we don't know what is going to happen. What is going to be the situation according to you, Dr. Gopa? And lastly, the issue of debate on effectiveness of those vaccines. A number of vaccines have been produced, and the side effects. We know that WHO did say that the advantages, although there are side effects, but the advantages outweigh the disadvantages. I mean, there's a lot of debate on that. We need to be. That's why a lot of people are not too interested to do vaccine in Mauritius. I mean, now, because they fear that they might have more problems than good. This, I just want to have your views, Dr. Guba.
Thank you, Comrade Sadin. Dr. Guba, my question is that you, in your presentation, you emphasize the fact that funding of vaccines should be from public funding, not private. But we know capitalists will always look for opportunities to make profit. What is your take in this now that countries are complaining of the accessibility of the vaccines? At a certain point, WHO also expressed their concerns around the manufacturing of the vaccine, that it looks like now the manufacturing is slow. As you have said, the four companies or three companies that you out of 14, they are not coping with the demands. Do you think if COVAX can allow the bilateral arrangements to purchase or to acquire or to access the vaccines could be the solution? What is your take on that one? Comrade Baba Aye, it remains a shocking imbalance in the global distributions of vaccines. Is there anything that the that African continent can do together so that we show that solidarity that we normally preach about? Maybe through AU, can we then be able to purchase our own vaccines at a central place and distribute them? Could that be a wise decision? Because indeed, you cannot live on donations. We need to do other things for ourselves, especially if we are preaching the word of solidarity. Thank you. May I give the presenters an opportunity now to respond?
Thank you. Thank you, Comrade Rita. I think I'll start with the first question from you, then move to Sadin's and other colleagues. So regarding the vaccine availability, I think the primary responsibility of public health is always state, and we should not waste that, allow the state to waste that responsibility in the private hands. That is what happens when we leave the responsibility of public health in the private hands, then the people's health get compromised. Private sector, as is really said, it looks for the opportunities for profit, and without profit also it cannot survive. So there comes the state as an as an independent arbiter between the open market and the people, to ensure that accessibility is not compromised. So there are, when protecting the reasonable profit of the private sector, state can still ensure access. But we should not give a free hand the private enterprises to set their own prices and their own profit motive to be placed above the people's health. So that is the important lesson, and the COVID vaccine research clearly shows that. Oh, one more thing, that if the public fund can be made available and can be pushed, then you can get the desired result. But here, what the governments, especially governments in the developed countries have done, they have pushed the money to do the vaccine research, but they decided to give a free hand to the private enterprises to enjoy the fruits of the that research. Okay, so they are not focusing on the dissemination of that dissemination of the research outcome. So in a way, there was a complete de-risking of the R&D as well as manufacturing of the vaccines. But the governments allowed also to privatize the entire profit occurring from the R&D effort. So this is the problem. So we need to scale up the production and ensure access. So only through the competition and only through the scaling up of the production, you can bring the competition and bring down the prices and ensure availability. Here it is not only the price alone, the products are not available to meet the demand. So we need to address that urgently. So this is what I would respond to Comrade Sadian's question also. And then moving towards the fake news and the vaccine hesitancy existing in many parts of the world, including in my country. I think the unions like PSI can play a major role, because the health workers, they are the role models, whether it's community health workers or even the workforce working in hospitals. So they are the role models here, and they can play a major role by demystifying about the vaccine and busting the myths circulating around regarding the side effects of the vaccine. And there are WHO has myth-busting series, and they do have published various materials, including one on I pasted here on vaccines. What I would say is that there would be there is nothing safe always. You cannot assure any vaccine as 100% safe. But those things are, happens in a very, very small percentage of people. It happens. But there are mechanisms to address also most of the time. I think we need to communicate to the people about the benefits of the vaccine and also make them aware of the potential side effects, etc. I think on regarding variants, I think it's already answered by Peter already. There are still work is going on, but especially the AstraZeneca vaccine has been rejected in South Africa because it's not that efficacious with the particular variants. But other vaccines, they are conducting research. How can they address the variants? And many variants this vaccine can address, but recently there was a news also from Pfizer that they are trying to develop a booster dose. Then yesterday, the U.S. Official Fauci told that one of the vaccines from India, that's a Covaxin, is useful to cover around 512 variants. But there could be other variants which with that vaccine may not able to cover, but for the moment, many vaccines can cover many of these variants. Okay, so that is what I would like to respond to the questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kova. Comrade Babaye.
Thank you very much, Comrade President. Well, if we're talking of the immediate quick fix. Yes, something along the lines of a concerted AU effort might make sense. But I think it is important to focus more on winning this TRIPS waiver, which seems closer to be won than ever. I mean, I think that in the light of the campaigns, the Biden's seeming turn and all that, it's not as if it's not yet won, but we should not throw into the mix of the narrative what could strengthen some of the third way illusions that our own Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, for example, was presenting, because this would now be something to latch on more to. Then there was something I can't remember. I think it was teacher Fabis who was pointing that out earlier, of capacity. in Africa? Because one of the things we keep stressing is it's the TRIPS waiver is very important, but not on its own alone. It has to also be go along with the call for, you know, sharing of know-how and technology. Then there has to be material capacity for them utilizing such. There are a few countries on the continent which could have this. Then we could talk of a more holistic AU concerted efforts. If, for example, maybe you say there's production going on in, say, South Africa, Senegal, Nigeria, Kenya, then you can. But a very important part of capacities, it's not just a technical thing, it's also political. A lot of production capacity of nation states on the continent were cut down at the turn of the century as part of this Washington consensus. I'll give a very good example. Nigeria used to have it was FVPNL, Federal Vaccine Production Limited, FVPL. It was a state-owned enterprise. It produced, amongst other things, the vaccination for yellow fever and a number of other things like that, not only for Nigeria, but for the West Coast, for the subcontinent there. It was privatized. It was bought by Mayor and Baker. But this is the interesting thing. Mayor and Baker, on buying it, just kept it as a portfolio and rather imports stuff from United States of America. So there's the need for such, we surrender too much as part of this surrender to the neoliberal nonsense. I'm sorry to say, but yes, nonsense is what it is really. So even as I keep saying, we must not lose sight of the key issue at each point in time, but also at each point in time, we must not lose sight of the wood for the tree, no matter how big that tree is. We need to emphasize the need for a radical change in the political economy within which our crisis preparedness and response could make sense. I think this is of utmost importance. Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Baba Aye. Comrade Bambisa, can you respond to the question from Sibusiso Sonkasa on the distribution of vaccines to rural areas?
Yes. Comrade Sibusiso, it's a difficult question. And like Comrade Baba was saying, it's not easy to come up with quick fixes to say this is what can be done. But like I said earlier on, and like also Comrade Baba emphasized, I think this has got to do with capacity building, which is something that is in the long term. Not only capacity building in manufacture, but also in infrastructure development. And this obviously requires a lot of funding in public services, so that, I mean, roads are built up to create access to rural areas, to create access to hospitals that are in those remote areas. So it goes back also to the point on Africa having to focus on development. We are in the 21st century, and we're still complaining about underdevelopment. We're still complaining of corruption and all those things. So I think it's time we should, even as trade unions, make sure that we push for the awakening of our continent, so that we improve our economies, we improve our manufacturing capacity, we improve the provision of public services in our countries.
So, yeah, I do not see how in the short term what can possibly be done to improve access to those hospitals in rural areas and remote places. But I think this is also an open discussion that anyone can possibly contribute. Comrade Spoof.
Thank you, Comrade Fambisa. I'm noticing the hands, but I'm not sure whether those are the old hands. But you'll indicate, Comrade Sani Baba. Is that an old hand?
Yes, it's an old hand, and it refuses to go away. It refuses to go away.
Okay, Comrade Sadin, Comrade Sviseso, is that your old hand?
Yeah, no, thanks, President. You see, we are coming up with recommendations, and some of these recommendations for us to see them surface to light. It talks to Africa awakening, as Comrade Fambisa indicated, because one of the things that I wanted to advance is that as much as we are saying that we want to echo the issue of intellectual property, sharing of intellectual property for us to have the capacity to produce. One of the challenges is that in Africa, do we have that political will from our governments in terms of investing into infrastructure, developing that type of technology which has remained dormant for a very long time that we have neglected, and now all of a sudden we are waking up today that we are in a pandemic and we don't know how to respond. We are always looking outside as opposed to providing our own internal solutions. So how do we motivate our leaders in terms of prioritization into health infrastructure and all of that? Because one of my other biggest fears is that we are recommending a push on leveraging in terms of taxes. And we know what happens when the government collects lots of money through taxes instead of diverting the funds into development, infrastructure, and capacitation. You know, all of a sudden you get corruptions left, right, and center, and monies are disappearing, not knowing where they're disappearing to. So how do we find those solutions? Because I think it is in this platform where we're supposed to indicate that these are the challenges and these would be probably the relevant solutions in terms of addressing. Because it's not that we don't have the capacity to develop technology. We do have the capacity. We have the intellect. We have everything. But the political will, as well as the funding, into our own development, it is what is lacking. And what role do we play, even us as unions, in terms of ensuring that we protect our own and develop our own? Thanks, President.
Thank you, Comrade Sposiso. I'll allow Comrade Baba Aye to take this question, as we are about to close the webinar. Yes. I think the time is against
us. Yes, Chair. Yes. Can I? Do you have the floor now? Because
yeah. Precise, because the time is against us.
I will. There are things that need to be done on the ground. I think we need to base up. We need to base ourselves on what the WHO has been saying lately. They say vaccine alone will not overcome COVID-19. In fact, they made a series of recommendations that countries have to come forward it is vital for countries to avoid cuts in public spending. You know, now we've realized that in the health sector, in social sectors, that's got to be in public hands. And they have also made a recommendation that the target of spending an additional 1% of GDP on primary health care. I mean, they made a series of recommendations. They even mentioned that it is vital for government to invest in strengthening health services. So what I'm saying, we know what has happened in Mauritius. Last year, they have reduced the budget by 10%, cuts in public expenditure. And this year, they said they're going to again reduce it by 25%. So we said, government, how come? You've got to invest more now in equipment, because vaccine alone as the WHO has been saying, will not overcome COVID-19. And now we don't know what is going to be the future. So we need to pressurize and using as basis whatever the WHO has been recommending, and they are continuing to do that, so that at least government continues to invest in the health sector. And unfortunately, what they do, there's a lot of, we've got experience in Mauritius lately. They have also had the emergency procurement, you know, and outsource a lot of services. You know what this means, you know, when you outsource, you know what this means. Even the emergency procurement, there's a lot of wastage of public funds. So I think we need to campaign as other sub-region so that government invest more in the provision of public services, including healthcare.
Thank you, comrades. I'm really personal. I'm supposed to be in another meeting at first, but let me give an opportunity to Comrade Babia here to reflect on the political will of the African leaders to develop our own resources. We believe, Sposo is saying, we believe that we do have intellect, we do have resources, we do have capacity to manufacture our own vaccines. But he thinks that the problem that we are facing is the political will from Africa to explore our own things that we can use in terms of manufacturing the vaccines. If I've quoted you well, Comrade Sposo, so my apology if I didn't quote you well. But I'll give Comrade Baba Aye just a minute.
Yeah, I would also
to respond.
I'll do that quickly too. I've been in a meeting now, but this is very important. Very quickly, it's that, and this is why the kind of thing we're doing now is very important. The political will of leaders is largely the global context either helps to facilitate or to limit the extent to which global leaders, regional leaders, including in Africa, take steps. I'll give examples to buttress this. Yes, we had visionary leaders in the 60s and 70s, but that was not the only reason why you had such landmark steps that resulted in, you know, increase in health expenditure, commitment to education, and so on and so forth. It was part of a global post-World War II order, which was also where you had the welfare states in Europe, and so on and so forth. However, we have had the neoliberal order as the common sense. And this former thing, this former order was what informed the Lagos Plan of Action of 1979 that was eventually just kept in the cooler, just like the Alma Ata Declaration of 78 was kept in the cooler. These were echoes of an era that was being brought to an end by neoliberalism. So if you put Lagos Plan of Action side by side by NEPAD, you will see not only changes in Africa and the will of African leaders, but also changes in the global context. So this, I think, is part of why we need to fight for a new global common sense, you know, including that, look, health must always come before wealth, you know, people must come before profit, and so on and so forth. Then we, as trade unions, as social movements, can help to knock the political will of leaders in Africa in the correct direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Baba Aye. Colleagues, comrades, we have come to the end of our webinar. It is that vaccine is a public good. Although more than 700 million vaccines have been distributed globally, the richer countries have benefited more. They've benefited more than 87% than the lower income countries who have received 0.2% of the vaccine. We therefore have to continue to ask for the WTO to waive the IPs for vaccine and the tools and the health tools during this COVID-19 pandemic. Comrade Sunny, can you please close this webinar for us because the General Secretary is not here now?
Thank you, Comrade President, for inviting me actually on behalf of Rosa to make some closing remarks. I want to take this opportunity to thank you in particular, and then all the presenters, by Dr. Gopa, Comrade Baba, Ye, Comrade Fambisa, and Rosa, for finding time to be part of this webinar. You know, we're actually running behind time. We are quite late. So I want to take this opportunity to thank also all the participants for finding time to be here. As Fambisa mentioned, we are going to have another round of this webinar, which is going to focus on privatization so that other issues can also be addressed. Comrades, I wish you all the best. Have a great day and stay safe with your families.